From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You think it's bad now, the air in winter? Think about this. By 2040, we're going to have something like 3 million more people along the Wasatch Front. So if you figure that more than 75% of all Salt Lake City residents drive to work alone, you'll get a sense of what the car situation could be like. All of this is to say something's got to give. And forget the future for a moment. The air right now is bad enough. Today in the program, we're beginning a series exploring Utah's bad air problem, and we're going to begin with the car problem. We're talking about mass transportation, and we're hoping to hear from you throughout the hour today. Here are some of the questions we're talking about. Why aren't more people choosing mass transit? How do we compare with other cities? What do you change? What do you build or plan that will make any difference? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're going to do anything about the air quality problem in this state, you're going to have to deal in some way with the car problem. Most of the brown haze settling into Utah valleys during the dog days of winter and summer comes from the tailpipe of some kind of vehicle. So what do you do? What do you do that could change the equation? Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversation about Utah's air quality problem, and we're going to start with mass transportation. We're going to build the show around some very basic questions, and we're hoping to hear from you. We'll take your questions and comments right away, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, or our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Why aren't more people choosing mass transit? Is it the expense? Is it the convenience? How much of this is cultural? Is the West different from other places? Is Utah different from other cities? Who's doing it right? What are the models that Utah leaders should be looking to? And we're also going to ask this, just how much of this problem could we really solve with mass transportation, even if we did get it right? Again, 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. You can also join us on Facebook or on Twitter. Mike Allegra is joining us. He's the general manager of the Utah Transit Authority, better known to most people, of course, as UTA. And Mike Allegra, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
We also have with us Soren Simonson, who represents Salt Lake's 7th District on the Salt Lake City Council. During his 8 years on the council, he has made transportation and transit in the city one of his priorities. And Councilman Simonson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
We also have Andrew Gruber with us, the executive director of the Wasatch Front Regional Council. It's a planning organization focused on transportation in the area. And Andrew Gruber, welcome to you.
Thanks for being with us.
We should mention Radio West is teaming up with the KUER Newsroom to produce this series. And earlier today, KUER ran a story by Whitney Evans of the Newsroom. It's about how Utah uses mass transit. You can find links to that story and other pieces in the series on our website. So I wanted to start with, pretty straightforwardly, how much of a problem – I guess, Andrew Gruber, let me ask you. How much does traveled cars, vehicles, how much does that contribute to the – air quality problem?
Just about 50% of the most problematic emissions that we have along the Wasatch Front comes from automobiles. So the PM2.5, the particulate matter, these really small elements of pollution that you get deep down into your lungs when you breathe them, is coming out of mobile sources, cars, trucks that are on our roads.
Right. One thing you talked about, and I hadn't heard this, but I want to make the distinction because I think it's important. The big problem, you say, is not just the driving part. It's the starting the car part, the cold starts part, as you call it, cold starts.
That's right. This is an important issue that I'm not sure that all the commuters out there are aware of. The majority, in fact, 60 to 70% of the pollution from cars comes when you first turn your car on.
Yeah.
We call it a cold start because now these new cars in the last 10 years are so much cleaner. But it's the catalytic converter technology in the car that cleans the emissions. But it takes a few minutes for that catalytic converter to warm up.
Like how long?
About 2 to 3 minutes.
2 to 3 minutes. Okay.
So when you first start your car, that's when the majority of the emissions are coming out. And so that's true if you get in your car in the morning, you turn it on and you drive to work. And then if you jump in your car again and you drive to lunch, you have another start. The car or during lunch cools down for an hour. You start it up again. You've got all of those cold starts, and it's producing the majority of the problematic emissions.
How long does it take to cool down?
About an hour.
It takes an hour. So that doesn't give anyone justification to idle their car.
No.
Right?
Right.
Okay. Because I did wonder about that. I thought, oh, well, maybe it's – because it did raise the question whether it was better to – if you're going to go pick up your kid, you know, you're going to run your car 10 minutes. It's better to turn it off. The catalytic converter will stay
– The catalytic converter will stay warm unless it's about an hour. Now, it's – you know, reducing idling is an important element, but it's those cold starts that are the biggest problem.
Okay, let's get oriented here. Now, there may be this impression, I think, that Utahns are in some ways bad at mass transit, that people in the West are less inclined toward mass transit, or that there may be these cultural obstacles that we're in some way less urban-oriented in some way or more tied to our cars than other people. Mike Allegra, is that a myth or is there some truth to that?
You know, thank you, Doug. I just happened to ride transit up here and I could not get a seat. And I think that's indicative of our system during our peak hours. Right now, we are at capacity, just like our road systems. We are full up in the rush hour in the peak directions. Last year—
Now, is it true ridership? Is it an all-time high?
Absolutely. 43 million rides, boardings, last year alone, okay? We have seen a doubling of our ridership since we first started our TRAX systems. So we are doing great. It is being embraced by everybody, and we're so excited about the growth that we're seeing. Now, I want to make a clarification that we are doing buses and rail, but we also are responsible for carpooling and vanpooling and a whole host of other public transportation needs that are out there.
Okay, so let's talk about where Utahns – and Soren Simonsen, I want to get you on this sort of cultural question in a moment here, but I want to talk about – where Utahns fit in with other cities. Utah has more, as I understand it, has more more mass transit per capita than most other cities our size. Is that right?
We have a very extensive rail network now, more than most. We have a similar size bus fleet size, but right now we're not running the same number of miles that the other cities are running.
So the big question here is, are we all that bad? I mean, as I understand it, we're 3.5% in terms of our ridership, give or take. Is that right?
Well, right now, a third of the people that are coming to the University of Utah are taking
forget that, because the University of Utah is like 30%. That's crazy good, and that's terrific. And Salt Lake City is like 25%. But let's just say everyone, 3.5?
Right. Somewhere in there.
Okay. And where does that – how does that compare to other cities our size? 3.5%. We're somewhere in the middle.
We're good. We're better. We're about average for a city our size. We're probably a little bit on the lower scale because of our resource constraints.
What about Andrew Gruber and Soren Simonsen? What do you guys think about that? Or are we in the scheme of things not as bad as people think? Or where are we? Do you guys think?
Well, we certainly have an enviable mass transit system, and I've used transit systems all over the U.S. and all over the world, and my comments are a bit anecdotal. I've been riding transit since I was a kid, and I'm used to it.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to distinguish whether or not it's cultural or not. But we do have a very enviable system. There are cities twice our size that are running exclusively on buses. And we do know that people tend to prefer to ride rail systems when they can, when they're available. And so that's a very good position to be in. I think one of the challenges is that we're seeing tremendous usage of mass transit for the long commute trips.
Yeah.
We're not seeing it used for short trips. And most trips that people take are less than a couple of miles. And, you know, if there's an area for improvement and continuing to focus, that's probably where we can spend some time. That is a resource issue, as Mike said. We're defined by the resources we have available.
I want to get into that.
We're still spending most of our transportation dollars on highways nationally and in Utah.
Andrew Gruber, are we that bad in the scheme of things? 3.5%?
No, you know, as Mike said, it depends on where you're looking at and when you're talking about. At the most congested times, at the peaks, the buses and the trains are full. And that's a great thing. Overall, the total number of trips, if you look at every trip being taken at all hours of the day, the percentage isn't that high. But this is pretty consistent with what happens in other cities of our size around the country. What's so great is that we're thinking ahead here, because we have made incredible investments in our transit system here in Utah. over the last decade because our population is growing so fast. So what we have to do, and we're doing it, we're staying ahead of that curve.
We are doing it.
We are, and we need to keep doing it. I mean, the tracks lines that UTA has built, the front runner now going from Ogden all the way down to Provo and providing bus service so that people can get the shorter trips that Soren's talking about, accessing the rail system. We're moving in the right direction. As the population grows, to provide choices to people, if they want to drive, they can do that. But if they want to and can take transit, they have that option as well.
Okay, so I wanted to give people some perspective here. So if you're talking about cities that are relatively our size, we're talking about Memphis and Hartford and Rochester and Richmond, Jacksonville, Oklahoma City. Hartford, they have 3.7%. That's about close to where we are. That's the East Coast. That's not far off from where Salt Lake City is. Jacksonville, 1.5%. We're 3.5. That's way better than that. Rochester, 1.9. Sacramento, 2.3. We're better than Sacramento. We're better than Phoenix. We're better than Dallas, which is 1.9. Oklahoma City is 0.5%. But I guess the question is, are those the cities we should be comparing ourselves to or aspiring to? Soren Simonson, I know you went to Vancouver, for example, British Columbia, and we'll talk about some of the lessons you've learned there. But how are that's a city you say is kind of getting it right.
Yeah, and Vancouver's an interesting case study because they made a decision. Now, Canada's a little different than the U.S. because they don't have a national transportation department. Most transportation systems decisions are made at the local level. And they made a decision in the late 60s that there would be no freeways within the city limits of Vancouver. And so you go there today and you can get from Alberta to Vancouver on a freeway, but as soon as you enter the city limits, you're on surface streets. And that was an interesting decision that I think has really changed the character of that community. They have invested.
When did they make that? Was that
that was in the late 60s, early 70s.
So they anticipated growth,
yeah.
Planned for it in the sense that as opposed to focusing on freeways, they focused on subsurface.
They focused on moving people as opposed to moving cars. And I think that's really the distinguishing factor is when we start thinking about transportation not as moving vehicles but as delivering a service, the service can be delivered very efficiently using all sorts of means, including your feet. And we don't often think about transportation that way. The school of thought in a lot of the engineering schools has focused on how do we move cars as efficiently and effectively as possible. And that's starting to change. Certainly as awareness about some of the issues, I think we've come to the realization, especially with our rapid population growth, that we can't build roads to solve our congestion problems and we have to find other ways to solve them.
So you think that that's changing, that idea is changing?
Certainly it is among traffic planners and engineers, yes. And that's largely where the design of our systems comes from.
You know, I see a sea change happening in our community. I'm very appreciative of it. Over the last 50 or 60 years after the last war and the suburbanization of our community and proliferation of roads and cars, it was all a good thing at that time. But those interstate systems were really not designed as our commuter travel sheds. They become de facto in that position. And so the community, the Wasatch Front, the elected officials, the business community are recognizing the key relationship between transportation and land use. The decisions of where we live, work, and play are really the best long-term strategy to changing the air, to our energy consumptions, to our traffic congestion issues. So we're really going back to the future, if you will, and coming up with those kinds of tools and techniques that combine the investments that we're making in transit and transportation with where we live, work, and play. We're seeing that happen now. We have a 2040 growth plan that the elected officials have endorsed, and that's a long-term but really the best solutions that we see to all of the issues that are associated with our transportation systems right now.
But Andrew Gruber, hasn't part of the problem been that lawmakers have seen as the solution to the problem of growth, building more legacy highway was one of these examples. Have you a number of examples where they're saying, let's just build more roads? You're saying that dynamic is changing? Do you think that's true among lawmakers?
Well, if you look at what our state has done over the past decade, we've made significant investments in our transportation system. But it is not just roads. We've had the highest per capita investment in public transit of any region in the entire nation over the past decade. So are we expanding our road capacity? Yes. Are we expanding our transit capacity? Yes. Are we trying to design our roads so they function more effectively with high occupancy vehicle lanes? We are doing all of these things to try to accommodate the growth that's coming. And as we look out far into the future, as the population continues to grow, you know, adding more than a million people along the Wasatch Front over the next 30 years, we can't address that just by adding more capacity to transportation. You have to provide choices. But as Mike was saying, if we can respond to the market preferences that baby boomers or retiring have, maybe they don't want to live in a big house that with a three-car garage and have to take care of the lawn anymore. Millennials graduating from college have a preference in greater numbers than folks before to have live in a different kind of neighborhood.
So like high-density kind of housing, those kinds of things?
You know, a mixed-use neighborhood where maybe they live in a townhome or a condo and they can walk or bike to work. Their shopping is right there. The park is there. And if they maybe they have one car and there's a choice for them to take transit as well. And if we can do that, if we can accommodate some of that growth by providing options for people to live in these town centers, then at the same time, we can actually preserve the character of our existing suburban or rural communities. But we have to do all of this together.
It sounds like you're saying that the equation in terms of the way leaders are thinking about it is about right. They're thinking about roads the same way they're thinking about transportation. And Councilman Simonson, I would guess you don't necessarily agree with that, or do you? Do you think that the way the equation is being spread out by leaders, that they're thinking, okay, because you've been critical of the fact that the focus has been on roads more than it has been on public transportation?
Well, we're certainly doing more than we ever have, and that I wholeheartedly endorse. If you think about it, we probably have more than a third of our population on the Wasatch Front that doesn't drive. They're too young. They're too old. They have physical limitations. They have economic limitations. And they simply don't have a car to use. And we certainly don't spend anywhere near a third of our transportation investment in options to serve that broad population. And that's really what I'm trying to advocate is let's think about all of the people in our community and how they move around. If you go into a crowded room of people that are middle-aged like I am and say, how many of you walked to school when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Most hands would go up. If you ask those that are parents, how many of you have kids that walk to school? There may be less than 5% of the hands that go up.
Why?
A lot of factors. People are concerned about safety.
Yeah.
We don't have facilities. We've built a lot of schools in Salt Lake City as we've been replacing our old schools with new ones without bicycle facilities. And
so we're not a walking.
We're starting to change that now.
Yeah.
I think we've realized some of our past sins, and we're working on rectifying those. Salt Lake School District right now is working on adding in bicycle facilities in schools that don't have them because there's that demand is coming from the community.
I think that's an important point here is that we're looking towards the future. The investments we're making in transportation are very long term. And so we need to be thinking about the millennium generations and the way their habits, as Soren has just talked about. They like to text and Twitter and tweet. They really don't like the obligation of driving a car. And so there's a change, a sea change going on in our community. That's years in front of us, but we're seeing that happen right now. And I want to go back to one point for a minute. Yeah. As I've been involved in transportation planning for 30-some years, when I first came here, 5% of the long-range plan, Doug, had an investment in transit. The 95% of the investments were proposed to be on highways. Today, and thanks to the leadership of the mayors and the Andrew Grubers of the world, almost a third of the investments we're recommending for the future are in public transportation. So there has been a sea change in recognition that we have to have a better balance out there.
Andrew Gruber, you wanted to say something else?
Well, I agree with Mike providing choices and not just public transit, but also giving people an opportunity to bike or, as Soren said, to walk. If you design communities in a way that it's safe and it's convenient, people may drive, but if they drive, they may drive shorter trips or they may use other options. I'll give you an example. The Daybreak community that's built in Salt Lake County on the west or southwest side of Salt Lake County, over 80% of the kids that live in Daybreak are walking to school. And that's because the community's been designed in a way that there's sidewalks and people feel safe. So their parents don't have to throw them in the car and drive them around to get them to school. So the way that we design our communities is so important to this issue.
And are we thinking about that, when the way we're designing our communities now? One thing, Soren Simonson, you've talked about was the fact that I think you told us, aside from Logan and Park City, there isn't a city in Utah that has a transit plan that deals, that talks about how transit serves the city. Did we get that right?
Yeah. You know, Park City and Logan have their own transit districts, and they're very localized service. Most of the Wasatch Front is fed by a regional system, and for those regional needs, it works really great. One of the things we've been discovering in Salt Lake City is that we have four transit operators. If you think about UTA, the University of Utah campus shuttle system, the airport shuttle system, mm-hmm. and, of course, the school buses that take kids to and from schools. We actually have four mass transportation operators right here in Salt Lake City today. They're not always well integrated, how those systems interface with each other. And although the transportation coming in and out of Salt Lake City is fantastic, if you're going to the University of Utah or going to downtown or one of those major employment centers, it's not always convenient to get from your home to a place to shop or to a school or a park or some of those other destinations. And that's one of the things that we're really interested in exploring. So just last week, the city council had a retreat, and one of the high priorities for us was to develop a mass transit plan for Salt Lake City over the course of the next year to 18 months, and look at how we can better work with all of the transit operators in Salt Lake City to provide services so that we're getting the greatest efficiency out of those systems that we can. And that might direct us to tweak a few bus routes here and there to provide better service from neighborhoods to shopping centers and recreation places. And it may also suggest that maybe we need to look at how we might, as a community, fund and work with UTA to provide enhanced service, maybe more frequent service on certain routes. Right now, the most frequent lines run at about 15-minute headways.
Yeah. I want to talk about that as we
go. And we may want to look at how frequent service needs to be in order to make it a more attractive option for some people.
Andrew Gruber, how important are bicycles in the equation?
They're very important, and actually this goes back to where we started this conversation about cold starts. You know, the caller just said that he talks about riding his bike on a red air day, and that's a good thing to do in terms of air quality, but it can't start there. We know that once we get to a red air day, we've already got the pollution that's trapped under the inversion. We've got to be working back days before that. So if the air is clear and you know that an inversion is coming, we've got to start changing behaviors in the days in advance. And so what do we do about that? Well, ride your bike, take transit if it's accessible to you, telecommute, right? Work from home. Employers can provide opportunities for their employees to work from home. They can have flex time so that they're not traveling when the roads are congested. But all, you know, trip chaining, so that, like we were talking about before, Doug, you go one trip to another so your catalytic converter stays warm. If we can do all of those things in the days leading up to a red air day, we reduce the number of cold starts dramatically, and that is going to cut down on the emissions.
So if you're doing a carpool, don't all meet in one place because you're going to all start your car, right?
Exactly. Much better to have one person. You know, it may be a little less convenient for that one person, but that one person start their car one time and drive around and pick up your coworkers. And then you've got two starts on the way in and on the way home instead of eight if you're picking up three people.
Yeah. That's Andrew Gruber. He's the executive director of the Wasatch Front Regional Council. Also with us, Soren Simonson, who represents Salt Lake's 7th District on the Salt Lake City Council. And Mike Allegra is with us, the general manager of the Utah Transit Authority. We should mention Radio West is teaming up with the KUER Newsroom to produce a series of these programs talking about Utah's air quality. Earlier today, KUER ran a story by our reporter Whitney Evans, which is about Utah's use of mass transit. You can find a link to that and to other pieces in the series on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about mass transportation. It's the first in our series of conversations about Utah's air quality. John is with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Hi. First, I'm a millennial. I prefer the urban environment. I live right downtown, and rather than driving, I'd prefer to have my hands free. And my biggest concern here in the state is the air quality, and yet I never take transit. I never do. So point two is why, and three is my thought on how to fix it. So the decision to take transit is, I feel like, a game of prisoner's dilemma. We all benefit from the better air if we all take transit, but there's a little cost to that, the cold and the winter and the heat in the summer. But the personally rational decision for each individual is to protect ourselves from that cold and heat and the particulate matter and to drive a car. So assuming everyone acts in that similarly individual, rational manner, the air is going to continue to get worse, and there's no way to get us all to the ideal. So I think the fix is to get us into transit in the spring and the fall when the cost to individuals and families is the lowest. The air is clear and cool, and that habit of riding transit in the spring and the fall will pour into the summer and the winter. So I think that the solution is to start long before the green air days of the winter when it's easy to ride transit, and that is really the only way that we're going to get people like me who should be riding transit into the train.
Does it make sense, guys?
Absolutely. You can't fix a red air day on the day. This is long-term and systemic, and I would agree with John that we have to transfer people's habits. Now, recognize,
but a lot of this is about that, right? Changing the sort of cultural expectations and people's sense of behavior, I guess.
You know, 75% of the people that are riding UTA today have a car. Yeah. They're choosing to ride us. How do we get more people to ride us? We have to provide that equitable level of service that's comparable to your car. When you wake up in the morning, you're making that choice whether you're going to get in your car or whether you're going to take transit. And right now, we have great coverage of transit. We don't have the frequency of service to make it as convenient as the car is.
Here's another issue, and this came up time and time again as we put this to listeners in Facebook and emails this morning. It's too expensive. So I wanted to go over the costs. This was one of the things, as I said, we heard a lot about. The base fare is $2.35 each way. Costs nearly $5 a day then. Put that in perspective. How much of that covers UTA costs and expenses, first of all, Michael Agarit?
About 15 to 20% of the costs of our service comes out of the fare box, what people are paying for us every day.
So if you were to – let's say you didn't have sales tax revenue and you had to just rely on fares. How much would a fare be? Have you ever thought about that?
It's closer to $5 a person.
So I guess the question is, a lot of people are saying it's too expensive to do this. Andrew Gruber, how much of that is an obstacle for people, the fact that it's $5 for a trip?
Well, it certainly matters, particularly for folks that are lower income. It matters a lot, and so we try to do everything we can. And I know UTA provides some discounts to riders who get a monthly pass. They provide all sorts of ways to incentivize people and make the costs lower. But you also have to keep in mind that if you're a regular user of public transit, you are reducing costs in other areas. The obvious one is you're not buying gas as much. If you use it enough, if it's convenient enough for you to use regularly, you may not need to have two cars. You can have one. Or in Utah, you have two instead of three, perhaps. And then you're reducing your costs on buying a car, you know, on your upkeep of the car. Further, more people can use transit and you keep cars off the road, you're reducing the impact on the road. You can actually save money on maintenance of the roads. And the more people that are using transit, the more cars that stay off, you can reduce costs in that way as well.
So, but what's the answer to people who are saying that that's a problem for them? It doesn't sound like there's any effort to change that fare. The $2.35 seems to be about where you're going to settle. Doesn't even cover your expenses entirely. And is there any effort at all to deal with that as a question, to try to decrease that and maybe increase the government's load in terms of taxes and things like that?
Yeah, Doug, good question. You know, part of the dilemma for us is understanding the true cost of the car. Over the last 50 or 60 years, we've embedded facility costs and parking costs and all those kinds of things that are really the true cost of operating your car. You can save a lot of money if you get rid of that second or third car, if you will. Or if you just want to look at the price of fuel, the price of gasoline, it's a little more a difficult equation, but it still works out for transit. And we
to your benefit, is that what you're saying?
To our benefit, correct. So one of the biggest issues is parking. And free parking at all of our facilities is really difficult for transit, if you will, because it isn't free. It costs an enormous amount of money, not just in dollars and cents, but in land use and facilities and those kinds of things. So that equation is changing. There is a lot of dialogue out there about what the appropriate balance is about all of the fees for our transportation systems. Let me add, though, that 25% of our population that don't have a car are what we call the transit dependent. And we have an enormous number of programs to accommodate. We give out.
If you can't afford it, then you have a way to help.
We have lower fares for the low income and for the seniors. And we give out free passes to a number of homeless providers, et cetera. So we're trying hard to accommodate that community out there that doesn't have the resources. But for those choice riders that are choosing to ride us, we're trying to make sure that they understand that equation.
So I want to give some more perspective because I think this is interesting when you compare Salt Lake City to other cities. If I lived in Portland, Oregon, I would spend about the same, $2.35 for a fare. If I lived in Seattle, it's a little bit more than that. It's $2.75. If I lived in Las Vegas, it's $3 for a fare. In Denver, it's a little less than here. It's $2.25. Phoenix, it's $1.75. So in terms of fares, I guess we're somewhere in the middle there. We're pretty much average, I guess. Is that right? Fair to say?
That's fair to say. But there's other ways that we can address this fare issue as well. Employers have an opportunity to provide passes to their employees. At our office, we do this. We provide transit passes so that all of our employees can use transit for free. And we get those passes at a significantly discounted rate from UTA. So there are a variety of ways to address this issue.
This is why the University of Utah has 30% ridership, I guess.
Right? Yeah. One of my goals is to have a pass in every pocket. In other words, you have keys. And you wake up in the morning and you decide. We're trying to use technology, Doug, to get to the point where everybody can make that decision and do it easily. So as you may know, we have an ISIS program where you can use your mobile phone. We have credit card technology where you can tap on and tap off. All of the universities and major institutions have these cards. We're trying to get out there to eventually have a cashless system so that anybody, anytime, randomly or regularly, could take transit by just tapping on and tapping off. And not having the correct change, et cetera.
Let's talk about the big broad question of convenience that, if you take – and we heard this again. Cost was one. The other thing was convenience, that time and time again people would say, look, I would love to use a bus or take tracks. But when I add it all up, it takes me an hour. Where if I get in a car, it takes me 10 or 15 or significantly less. What do you do about that?
Let's be realistic. Nobody is talking about 100% of people using transit. Okay, it's not going to work for every person. It's not going to work for every trip. However, there's an opportunity to make it work for more people, for more trips than it's being used right now, and particularly into the future as our population grows. Where are a million people going to go in this valley? Well, one place that they can go is we can have, as we talked about before, mixed use development where new homes are built closer to our existing transportation assets, to our transit systems.
So it'll be more convenient if we plan our communities properly.
It will, and then people will have that choice. And now look at what we've done now. As we said before, we have Front Runner commuter rail that goes from all the way from Ogden to Provo. We've got this long, linear region that we live in that is perfectly suited to commuter rail. If you're coming down into Salt Lake City from Ogden, the amount of time that it takes to drive is just about the same amount of time as it takes to take commuter rail. And when you're on the train, you've got all that time that you can use to do whatever you want for yourself. So for some people, it is going to be just as convenient as driving.
There was a recent Brookings Institution study that showed Utah has a real potential to get this right. 64% of residents live within a 90-minute ride. Right. So there is the potential there. to get to Soren Simonson, you wanted to?
Yeah, I was just going to add too. There, you look at the central part of the valley that was laid out using largely the grid that was platted by Brigham Young when Salt Lake was founded, and that grid of streets works very, very effectively for transit. I think it's one of the reasons that we're seeing success in places like Daybreak. Daybreak not only was designed around the transit system, but it also was designed around people being able to walk and ride their bikes. And so if there's any lessons to be learned from the last 50 years in the way we've planned and designed our cities that has application in what we do for the next doubling of population in the Wasatch Front, we should at least learn that we need to design communities to be transit-ready and pedestrian-ready and bicycle-ready. And that means that cul-de-sac subdivisions are probably out and gridded networks of streets are in because they're very, very adaptable to all sorts of choices for transportation and mobility.
Is that sensibility getting to the suburbs? I'm still seeing an awful lot of cul-de-sac subdivisions
there
being
are,
built.
And sprawl repair is very, very challenging. It's difficult. There is a whole movement right now nationally and internationally, really, although the United States and Australia are probably the worst places in the world in terms of sprawl and subdivisions. But there is an entire movement now in the city planning world that's focused on how do you reconnect communities and add in uses and bring services and conveniences to neighborhoods that were designed completely around the automobile and people driving 10 or 15 minutes for all of those daily services, that people are simply getting fed up with the congestion that they have to deal with in those situations. And so that's something that certainly is, I think, going to continue to draw attention and focus. And it is here as well.
Soren Simonson. He represents Salt Lake's 7th District on the Salt Lake City Council. Mike Allegra, also with us, the General Manager of the Utah Transit Authority. And Andrew Gruber is the Executive Director of the Wasatch Front Regional Council. It's a planning organization focused on transportation in the area. Radio West is teaming up with KUER Newsroom to produce a series of these programs about Utah's air quality. Earlier today, KUER ran a story by reporter Whitney Evans about the use of mass transit. You can find a link to that story and to the other pieces we're producing in the series at radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about Utah's air quality. This is the first in our series. We're talking about mass transportation. Back to the phones. David is with us in Salt Lake City. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I'd really like to address is the idea of free public transit, such as Park City has. I think it's doable there, it's doable here, but really kind of a side note and quick thing of as Soren Simonson is well aware, scooter is a great option, and it is much cheaper and it's much more convenient, but it's not going to work for everybody. But we can get free fares with a really small and insignificant increase in fuel tax, and I think it would be beneficial to the remaining drivers as well because, of course, there's going to be less traffic on the roads to compete with. It's also going to build in a lot more efficiency because of the increased usage of public transit. And I'd really like to see that idea happen. Maybe it needs a token quarter fare, something like that. But I think it's realistic, and I think it's something that we do need to fight for.
Mike Allegra, let me get you to respond to that. And as you know, there's a bill, I think it's moving anyway, in the on Utah's Capitol Hill by Democratic Representative Joel Briscoe, that would introduce that would pay for free UTA passes, not all the time, but during the months of January and July, those two peak times for bad air quality. What do you make of, first of all, the caller's response, but also this particular bill, the idea of free transit?
I think David hit on it, is that there needs to be some way to cover those costs that we would lose, because at the end of the day, the key for UTA is more service. as I mentioned before, where we do have crowded facilities in the peak hours, and our goal is to actually put more service on the street. So we have been investigating programs where businesses and institutions can help us cover those costs. So working with legislators and others out there, we're about ready to introduce some programs that will allow us to offer some reduced fare rides. But they're going
but
to be
covered.
But you're
also in the process of trying to raise fares, or at least talking to people about that.
So fares will continue to go up as a percentage of our costs, just like all of the other costs.
And you're saying you have to right now, unless you find an offset, right?
We think it's reasonable to expect that the people using our system pay a certain percentage of those costs. We try to keep those low. As I mentioned to you right now, I think we're at 22%. And we think getting to 25% is a reasonable goal.
What would that mean for a fare?
Again, it will go up with the inflation costs and those kinds of things. You may know we have a fare increase scheduled already, anticipated for April, which will go to $2.50. Right now, ISIS is offering free rides if you use their mobile phone systems on every red burn day for the rest of this year. We have corporations like Kennecott that are offering passes to users to ride for free. We're trying to infect that idea out there with the entire business community and other institutions to help us cover those costs. But at the end of the day, that's not a quick fix, if you will. There's no quick fix to this. It's really a longer-term systemic solution.
Let me ask you all let's be candid and realistic for a moment about the potential for transportation in terms of dealing with air. Even in the best of circumstances, it seems like we're only going to really be able to attract a fraction of commuters to mass transit. I mean, Denver is looked at as doing it pretty well. They've only got 4.3% ridership. Utah has 3.5 right now. Let's say we get better. We get to 4.3 or 4.5. Is that going to make a dent in terms of the air quality? Will that really affect the quality of air if we get the best we can?
Well, of course it will. It there's no silver bullet to our air quality problem. I think everybody knows this. Having people use transit is one strategy to reducing emissions. And, you know, you're talking about 3%, 4%. Remember that at the peak hours, morning commute, and evening commute.
So it's way higher than that.
It's way higher, yeah. And those are the times when the roads are the most congested. And if you're sitting in traffic congestion, you're producing more emissions. So using transit is one strategy, and then the other strategies we talked about before, all of these things have to be done, telecommuting, carpooling, trip chaining, flex time, all of these strategies that can be used. But that's just one area, right?
You can't isolate the issues. You're saying we have to think about it holistically.
Absolutely. Anybody who thinks that there's one magic button we can push is kidding themselves. We all have to participate in these strategies. And it's not just the transportation area, right? What we do in our homes, what businesses and industries do, we all have to collaborate together. So just to say that, using transit won't solve the problem is too dismissive. We need to do as much as we can on transit, but we need to do other things as well at the same time.
Michael,
I was just going to add that there are a suite of options, as Andrew has talked about. And when you talk about transit, that's one component. But carpools, van pools, we have 400 vans in our systems. We're looking to add more, as many of those as we can put out there. When you put all those together, we're in double-digit numbers. And we think we can, in fact, double that. The long-range plan that's being recommended gets to that point where that's when we begin to have a significant impact on our air and our energy and our congestion.
Soren Simonson, let me ask you a political question. Is there the political will in this state by lawmakers to do something significant to deal with frequency, convenience, cost, those kinds of things in terms of mass transportation broadly?
Well, we're certainly seeing a move in that direction. I mean, we are the most conservative state in the U.S., and we are the most rapidly expanding transit system in the U.S. So there must be some correlation. And if you think of conserving resources as a conservative value, mass transit is a great way to conserve resources. If you think of conserving quality of life as a conservative value, it certainly is an important piece of the puzzle.
But are lawmakers thinking that way?
I think many are. You know, we certainly heard in the governor's State of the State address just a couple of weeks ago that air quality and tackling this issue is certainly one of his highest priorities.
But
and
I think there's that message not one is bill through. Being presented by Republicans in the Utah legislature to deal with Utah air quality. And it wasn't only until last week that Democrats came up with bills to deal with it.
Well, I think it is the case that it is a very large and a very complex problem, and transit is only a small piece of the puzzle.
Right.
And I think people are trying to figure out how do we address this, and we want to do it systematically, and we want to do it thoughtfully and carefully. I suspect that it will take a couple of years before we really have some solutions that may rise to the top of the legislature's list, but I think we'll get there.
I want to just add the technology part of this because, as you know, we have electric trains. We have invested in hybrid electric vehicles. We have a very interesting project up here at the University of Utah of an all-electric bus, and we're investing heavily in working with the legislature right now, and there are some bills out there that are active dealing with CNG facilities. So we see a large component of our fleet going to CNG.
So you are seeing interest by conservative lawmakers to deal with this issue.
Yes.
Okay, Mike Allegra is the general manager of the Utah Transit Authority. Thank you very much for being with us. Soren Simonson represents Salt Lake's 7th District in the Salt Lake City Council. Thank you very much to you.
Thank you.
And Andrew Gruber, the executive director of the Wasatch Front Regional Council. Thank you very much for being with us as well. We're going to shift gears here for the last few moments. Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, is joining us because I wanted to get a sense of first – Terry, what do you figure we learned today? What's your sense of listening to the conversation so far?
I learned a lot of interesting things, Doug. First of all, when the most emissions or the most harmful emissions are coming out of your car, that was enlightening to me about starts and cold starts and when you're in the drive-thru and to turn your car off and when not to. Sounds like pretty basic information, but I think that as we try to raise our awareness about our driving habits, that was a really important fact to sort of reinforce, I thought. Looking at this really tremendous conversation on public transportation, one of the things I took away is that it's going to take some personal sacrifice if these issues are important to you. We had a caller call in talking about, well, my commute, you know, down 39th to downtown is only 15 minutes by car. It's an hour by bus or train or whatever combination that individual would have to make with transit. But we look at where we are relative to the rest of the country, and our transit infrastructure is really quite good relative to other cities.
Do you think that's a myth that we kind of dealt with today, that people think it's – you know, and maybe this is a case wherever you are, you just sort of figure your systems aren't working like other places, that they're better in other places. But I did get a sense today that there's a lot of thinking going on about this question.
There is a lot of thinking. I think our transit system is strong relative to other cities. What we have is an air quality issue that a lot of other cities don't have. So that really raises the stakes. That heightens the situation. And also, as these gentlemen have talked about during the show, our commuter peaks are getting larger as far as the number of people that are riding transit. So it's an issue on people's minds. And I've tried to change my driving habits this season as well, only take one car, take the bus home when I can, that kind of thing. I think people are thinking in that mode. But it's, as Whitney Evans' story pointed out this morning, and she followed one person on their commute from Salt Lake to Provo, who, if she drove, would take 37 minutes. She decides to take Front Runner, takes 2 hours, but she feels that that's an important thing that she needs to do, and she can get work done on the train, that she can use those hours during her day. She also interviewed another gentleman who decided to, as soon as the Front Runner line was operating down to Provo, he sold his car. So I think people are making those sacrifices. Yes, government needs to have a role. Yes, we need to worry to look into how industry is contributing to this, but as Utahns and as folks who live up and down the Wasatch Front, there needs to be a sense of personal sacrifice and figuring out how we're going to change our habits.
Where we sort of ended up was on this question of political will. What's your sense of that?
Well, the next story in our series, which will be a week from today, will focus on what's happening in the legislature. Now, at the beginning of the session, it didn't seem like much was happening at all, and that they're contemplating cuts to the Division of Air Quality. I'm not sure where the fiscal situation is with the DAQ, but Democrats in the House have responded now. Joel Briscoe, Patrice Arendt, Rebecca Chavez-Houck, and other Democrats are pushing about six bills that they haven't formally introduced yet. They're still working on the fiscal notes on them, but among them is Joel Briscoe's bill to try and work out some free passes during January and July for transit. The Republican bill out there is from Lori Snow from Washington County. He's looking at trying to work on some tax alterations or exemptions for clean fuel vehicles. So it's not that, like, the Republicans haven't been doing anything per se. I've spoken to some of the Republican leaders, and they say some things are in the works. And Governor Gary Herbert is really trying to raise an awareness about this. So it continues to be a huge issue at the Capitol, and protests from various groups continue to happen.
Do you sense the gentlemen who were joining us earlier talked about some of them that there was some sense there might be a sea change in terms of thinking? You're seeing language in the State of the State address, as you mentioned. Lawmakers are starting to think about this in a different way. Do you think that there is something of a sort of shift in the landscape?
There has to be, because this is something that affects everybody, regardless of what political party you're affiliated with, regardless of what you believe in all different other kinds of modalities. So I really think that legislators have to deal with this right now. It's becoming the topic in the session.
Which is the issue for next Thursday's piece. This is Thursday morning?
Correct. Thursday the 21st. I'll be the reporter on this piece, actually. So I'll bring you a story on what's happening and what's not happening in this legislative session.
And let me mention Whitney Evans. Terry mentioned her story about Utah's mass transit and how people use it. You can find a link to that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Terry, thanks.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks also to Taylor Almond. Radio West produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.